us now Victoria Young, who is Business Desk's editor. Kia ora and good morning, Victoria.
Good morning, Catherine.
And congratulations on your elevation.
Thanks. It's quite an exciting time for us at Business Desk.
Wonderful. So, yeah. Let's get into the business of universities. This is another of your series.
Yes. So, as we've discussed on the show earlier, the business of education is our latest series looking at, obviously, the education sector. And just what we're doing at the moment is just looking at universities. Obviously, they are not-for-profits, but we're looking at them through a commercial lens. And, you know, this is quite an interesting topic because the last year has seen wave after wave from a lot of the major universities of cutbacks, redundancies, whether it's staff cuts, courses being dropped. So there is a lot going on in this sector, starting off with, I guess, Auckland University, or University of Auckland, I should say, which yesterday reported its result for the calendar 2023, and it has made a surplus. It is probably one of the few that is likely to report a surplus. It's first out of the block, so we don't actually know the others, but we've seen some forecasts. So they've got a surplus of $30 million and an overall net surplus before tax sort of for its group, which includes its commercialisation arm, uni services, and the foundation. But a lot of that is to do with the growth in fund valuations of its charity arm, as opposed to, you know, the bread and butter of, you know, providing courses and doing research and making projects. So it's a very interesting time for the sector.
So what's next then for Auckland University?
Well, we see it as one of the, as I said, stronger players, but it is, you know, it is what it's seen is it's seen 10% revenue growth. So you'd think that would be good, but this is being outpaced by rising expenses. Now, all of the universities sort of as a collective are asking for the government for more money. They're asking for, you know, what they're able to get from that fee base to keep pace with inflation, which we know, you know, has been quite rampant of late. But what we also sort of know, you know, in the context of all sort of government areas is that everybody wants more money to pay more staff. So my understanding is that the universities are not, you know, not that optimistic about being able to just get more money. I mean, they were given, I think it was mid last year, they were given an extra, I think it was hundreds of millions, tens of millions of dollars just to keep going amidst all these cuts, which they've promised to do. But what they need to do now is look at, you know, international students. I mean, that's the big one. We know that an international student provides 1.6 times the revenue of a domestic student. And there's no, you know, you can't really make more domestic students. You know,
it's a tricky nexus, though, when you're taking a lot of public funding for a public good, being the education of a citizenry. You know, I know what you're saying. They need those income streams, but they've also They've also got to be careful on how far they go on that front if it begins to impact what people consider to be their core business. The second thing is they were so exposed with the growth in foreign students. They were so exposed with the pandemic. We're not hoping for one of those again later.
No, and that's not recovered.
Yeah.
There are things that they are eyeing up. For example, international students in Australia, there's been a bit of a crackdown. It's sort of like not a changing in the rules per se, but a changement in the way that the rules are enforced over there.
So,
yeah, and this is what you probably, you know, be interested in. You know, the domestic student, they, you know, New Zealand will be eyeing up possibly rejected students from Australia that can't get in because they're enforcing stricter language requirements and other sort of factors, which which, you know, from a business perspective, you know, we talk to the recruitment agents in this space, and you'd be surprised what a business it is, which will come out in one of our future articles. But, you know,
but it's a business that is leveraged off and leveraging off a large public taxpayer investment in the first instance to provide tertiary education in this country for New Zealanders. And this is where it gets so challenging. If your business income stream from an international business begins to impact in any way the provision of your core service that the taxpayers pay for, things can get tricky. And that could be anything from course selection to what's happening with research vis-a-vis other demands on academics' time, what they're choosing to teach, how they're choosing to teach it. This is where you've got to be careful how much you become dependent on that external income stream. What's happening, by the way, to the domestic enrolments? Because they took a whack, obviously, post-pandemic. They took a whack because, in some ways, kids were sick of signing up to university to sit on their beds at home on a laptop. And second, one imagines, because of low unemployment. And third, because a lot of youngsters just want to get the hell out of Dodge post-pandemic. But is there any indication of an upturn in the domestic enrolments, or are they going to be flat for a while?
No, it's taken a whack. And the interesting thing was, and this came out in the Select Committee, I think it was last week, for the Tertiary Education Commission. The TEC, which sort of funds and regulates this university, was actually not impressed by the forecasts that the universities had put forward, because they forecast for better domestic enrolments than they've got. So there is a real issue here. But, you know, I will say, you know, we talk about international students affecting domestic students. Massey University, they've opened up in Singapore. They want to get 5,000 students in Singapore. So this is quite an interesting play, because it doesn't even affect domestic students theoretically, right? Because you're literally not in the same classroom. And what they're aiming at is an international student market that can't even get visas to New Zealand. So they're looking at African students, Middle Eastern students that can get visas into Singapore and can get taught by Massey there. Now, I would say if that subsidises, or if that helps provide a decent income stream for domestic students here in New Zealand, then why not? Why not
for them to go? If it does... And again, this gets right to the heart of what universities are having to face up to, which is their public purpose in order to get their public funding, right?
Yeah.
And at a time where you've got a government saying, get back to core business, get back to core business, get back to core business to all and sundry. So I'm not by any means downplaying the logic of an income stream, a financial income stream from international students. But what I'm saying is it comes up against the core business argument for getting hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer funding as well.
Yeah.
And this is what they're going to have to navigate, because, like every sector, massive change is coming upon them.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that we should talk about is, as well, is these universities, okay, with core business research, core business teaching, they have some ancillary businesses, for example, accommodation, hospitality. That actually makes up about 55% of the surplus. So there's chunky money there. But it's right. It's what is the university's role in harnessing that, taking advantage of that, using their properties, you know, which, you know, mostly own.
A lot of them have got a ton of earthquake-prone buildings. And there's a lot of real estate that needs managing, and one wonders if you'll need as much going into the future.
There's a massive capital works issue, isn't there? Like,
how
is that program going to work? We know many times on this program we've talked about construction blowouts. Ugh, total other site issue. But these universities need to be managed, and a lot of them have, you know, corporate directors on their boards, and, you know, people looking at how these finances are managed. We talked about Auckland University today, but that's one of the, I would argue, one of the better ones. I mean, its surplus, $30 million, is way higher than what the others are predicting.
Well, a surplus is a good starting point.
Yeah, a surplus. I mean, we don't need them to make heaps and heaps of money, but we want them to be able to fund themselves, I think, as a baseline. Some of the other universities, you know, are basically restructuring, it looks like, well, it's hindsight, isn't it? But looks like they're restructuring too late, you know? Auckland University, its massive restructure was 2021. These other universities are doing it now, and it's just too late, and they might, you know, they're not ruling out cutting again. So
What else is going on that's affecting them? Obviously, the science funding's a big issue. We have the science minister on with us in the next wee while about intentions for future funding, because you just about need a PhD in flowcharts to understand how science is funded in this country. And some of the mechanisms by which it's funded are about to run out if they are not extended or replaced. So what else is going on that impacts the universities in terms of a wider review?
Yeah, so what we've heard and, you know, what our senior correspondent, Dilipa Fonseca, was reporting on Monday was, it's a bit hazy, but it sounds like Peter Gluckman, the former chief science advisor, has been picked or was being primed to lead this review of the university sector and the science sector. Now, how this would sort of sit together is not that clear yet, but what sort of our intel is that there's got to be some sort of review in how the Crown Research Institutes are funded and their links to universities and their commercialisation arms. And there's a lot of talk, you know, university-wise, I guess, in some sort of level of perhaps consolidation or just saying, you know, this university can specialise in this, this university should specialise in this, and let's not have all these competing bodies. For example, Auckland Uni Services, its commercial unit, which, you know, either creates sort of like IP by sort of creating a project and licensing it or sort of having these like service agreements. For example, one of the big ones is like with Nestle, where they come with to a deal that involves science applied to a product. You know, there is a sort of school of thought that thinks New Zealand should just be going all in on Auckland Uni Services and what it produces, because it is far and away better funded than some of the other research arms, and has, you know, when you look at all the rankings and so forth, what it's doing compared with what's in Australia, it's the only one that really competes in Australia and that sort of thing. So that is what we think this possible review.
There's that. There's certainly there's a bit of a push for Auckland there. But what's also happening is we've spoken to the VCs of Otago and Victoria, University of Wellington, both saying we need to cooperate more. We should not be chasing every student across every discipline in quite the volumes that we are. That would be a more sensible way to rationalise across courses across the country.
Yeah, it's kind of like, what's the point in fighting for market share in sort of something that's not really moving? Maybe it's about growing more pie. But, you know, the other thing that's interesting about Peter Gluckman and what we're not clear is whether this falls in scope of this sort of science innovation universities review is Callaghan Innovation, which is another sort of, it's not a Crown Research Institute.
The Crown Research Institutes as well, all of them,
I mean, the ACT Party, David Seymour, was very vocal. I mean, I know he's one of the coalition, but he was very vocal about thinking that Callaghan should be scrapped. So there is a very interesting political piece that will influence what goes on
here. What happens in future. Okay, very good. Let's crack through the next two. Property funds, not surprisingly, starting to feel the downturn. We know in the smaller parts of the construction sector there's been a screaming of brakes going on, as is always the case in a recession, regrettably, for those most directly impacted. But are the listed or the unlisted funds also beginning to feel the pain?
Yeah, we're starting to look at some of these property funds, you know, that high net worth or, you know, wholesale investors can get into. There is one, Fortland, basically not taking investments anymore. That one's sort of, you know, basically shut up shop. I mean, these are all sensible things that sort of need to be done. PMG sliced its monthly distributions just this January, and it's gone down 13%. To 5 cents per share. The other big one, lots of reporting on last week, Auckland-based Oyster Group, that's also suspended withdrawals and it's cut investor payments to 3 cents per unit. So they're all feeling the pinch, and investors are sort of being told this is kind of maybe what you would expect at this point in the cycle when you're investing in commercial property. I think a lot of the investor relations people, that's what they're telling us. What is it? Anyone in commercial property is going to be seeing reduced returns at the moment. But, you know, there are some out there that suggest this is maybe reaching the bottom of the cycle, because, you know, we're obviously looking closely at interest rates and
honestly,
where they're going to go.
Good luck with that piece of string. at the moment. but is it heavily pegged to when there may, whenever it is, be a downward push on interest rates?
Yeah, yeah. And we, I mean, you know, after last week's GDP announcement, there are, you know, there are economists saying this is happening November.
Yeah, you've still got a government saying it's not ruling out its full suite of tax cuts in the budget as well, yeah. Which of course work. The Prime Minister saying this morning does not have a stimulatory effect, but I can tell you every working person on a middle income who gets an extra dollar in their pocket at the moment is probably going to spend it. Yeah. So that's the other thing. We just don't know how this is going to play out or how long it's going to take. But yeah. Like many yeah. sectors, the fortunes of this one very dependent on not just a half, you know, or a quarter percentage point cut either, on a significant downward movement.
Yeah. Yeah, and these are all the signals. I think my colleague Rebecca was talking about liquidations last time. These are all the signals of what's coming in the tight ride that we're in. Mm.
Just finally, what's going on the PGG Rights and Boards, Victoria?
Yeah, I mean, I love a bit of a boardroom stoush. There is a real battle going on here because I think we've talked about previous on the show PGG Rights and there is a belief amongst the New Zealand Shareholders Association that Meng Foon, former Gisborne mayor, who has been on the board for quite some time, is not independent because he's linked to a major shareholder, Agria, and he was nominated by them. And he tends to, I think he has pretty much always voted along with that shareholder. So Meng Foon has been invited by the rest of the board to go. He's been told by the NZSA to go. There's been a lot happening and there's supposed to be a special meeting, but a date has not been set of where this is going. But technically he's independent and he told our reporter Riley Kennedy yesterday, no, I'm not going. I'm independent. That's that. But, you know, the NZSA wants to talk about this because they think it exposes a wider issue with New Zealand listed companies, and that is of the minority investors and the power that they have.
And so, could you elaborate on that warning?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, for example, in PGG Rights, and the whole reason this sort of issue is coming up is because Agria just has this massive stake. It's about 30% or a bit more. And so that's seen as controlling. And NZSA says that when you have a controlling stake in a company, which apparently I think it said 30% of listed companies do have these massive shareholders that really control NZX listed companies, then those shareholders shouldn't be able to vote on the election or re-election of independent directors. So it is saying this, you know, publicly. That's the NZSA's job in a way to advocate for the retail shareholder, and it is also pushing NZX to, you know, have some rules on this.
Very good. Thank you so much, Victoria Young, Business Desk's editor. That's businessdesk.co.nz.